Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Agriculture provides a $32.5 billion economic engine for South Dakota. A July study from the South Dakota Department of Ag reports there are 29,968 farms and 48,913 total producers in the state. With continued pain from closed international markets and sagging commodity prices, some of those producers are trying to find innovative ways to save those farms. With so much of the South Dakota landscape devoted to agricultural use, changes in the ag industry and changes in climate can have massive impact on how we use and interact with our landscapes now and in the future. Now, we've been talking about agriculture and the economy often this summer on In the Moment. We've also been talking about the nature of the grasslands. You can find relevant conversations with rancher and author Linda Hazelstrom and journalist Sam Hurst and Kevin Wooster on our website at listen.scpb.org. In hour two of In the Moment today, we welcome Don Carr with Environmental Working Group Midwest for a conversation about how subsidy money from the Trump administration is being distributed in the heartland. But first, Professor Megan Jarko joins me in the STPB Sioux Falls studio. She is associate professor at USD, and she's also the Sustainability and Environment Chair for the University of South Dakota. She's joining us today for a conversation about how we use our landscape and how native ecosystems matter in the economy dedicated to feeding the world. Dr. Jarko, welcome. Thanks for stopping by today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's get to know you first a little bit. Tell us about your background and how you ended up at the University of South Dakota.
So I am a South Dakotan. Since first grade, I grew up outside of Brandon, went to Brandon Valley School District, and then for college, went to Wisconsin and studied biology, but specifically looking at prairies. And then for my master's research was in Mankato, Minnesota, and looked at wetland ecology, so still looking at our landscape. And then for my PhD, went to Iowa State and studied sustainable agriculture and ecology. And so kind of all throughout thinking about our landscapes and what we currently have on our landscapes, what we historically had on our landscapes, and different ways we could think about it.
So prairie girl deciding to study the place where you're from, and that's not as common as the story as you might think.
Yes, and even being able to come back. So I got the faculty position at the University of South Dakota in 2012, and so it was really nice in that sense to be able to come back home.
Yeah. How old is the Sustainability and Environment program? How old is that program at USD?
We will be starting our eighth year this year. So we've had an undergraduate program, and then just starting last fall, we started a master's and PhD. So now we have undergrad through PhD in sustainability, which is exciting.
And are these science-based kids? This is a STEM program only, or do you find some of these students coming from an arts and humanities perspective too, and really asking some of these same questions that the science, technology, engineering and math students are asking?
We do. We have both of them. So there definitely is the STEM focus, and my background was in, biology, so coming from that natural science perspective. But then we bring in the policy, the equity aspects, and so we try to really cover the spectrum from the natural sciences through social sciences and also including humanities.
All right. What drew you to that? Was it just sort of a natural, you started out wanting to do biology and then, the idea of studying sustainability and how did you sort of find your way in that field? Because maybe it's not a new field. I think of it as a new field.
It is new. And yeah, I didn't have this on my radar when I was starting school. So I've really always loved plants. And so I studied kind of theoretical plant ecology. And then after my master's kind of realized I'm much more interested in the implied aspects. And so someone who's interested in thinking about how might we make a kind of have my knowledge contribute to seeing changes that happen in my lifetime led me to think about agriculture. So could I take my interest in plants and then think about agricultural systems? And so for my PhD, did that same idea, understanding of plant ecology, but taking it to these really managed landscapes and thinking about, are there ways that we can manage our landscapes in different ways than we're currently doing it?
All right. There's a huge history behind that as well, but it seems more urgent than ever. Does it seem more urgent than ever to you?
I mean, I think now there are a lot of things that are coming together that make thinking about our landscape really timely. I mean, in terms of, as you had mentioned, there's challenges to agriculture right now financially. Climate change-wise, South Dakota is so interesting in that, we're on the east-west divide, so we're at the more humid Corn Belt part of the state and this part of the state. But then there's the drier, you know, more out west in the western South Dakota. So then climate change impacts. And then there's also, I think, kind of increasing interest in thinking about, you know, as bee populations decline, thinking about getting more from our landscapes than we might have been asking from them in the past, you know, few decades.
Right. Is that shifting, that sort of, that notion of what we think now is sort of an East River, West River divide? It's really this 100th meridian. And it, as we look at how the climate is shifting, is that actually shifting one direction or the other?
Oh, that, yeah. And that is, I think, just extremely interesting. So in terms of history of our agriculture, we're kind of moving the Corn Belt west. But then climate-wise, right, there was what we thought about as the 100th meridian line, but this kind of stark contrast between the more humid east, which is what we're in, and then the drier west. And with climate change, I mean, at least the models that they're projecting, that that's going to shift, and it's going to be right about at us. And so we've got the Corn Belt moving
at us, wet. You mean?
As this region right here,
right,
around
Southeast,
Sioux Falls.
South, yeah, so we, yes, have a statewide audience today.
Oh, yes,
so
yes, yes, sorry.
Make sure we clarify.
Should,
yeah.
I, and I'm down in Vermilion. So us, the very far eastern part of the state, yeah, might be getting closer to this divide, which then, of course, gets us less suitable for the kind of agriculture that we've been doing, but yet we are moving it west across the state, which might even make it harder for those areas.
What are the implications of the westward movement of sort of that corn and row crop production?
We are at the divide between, you know, sometimes we have drought years, and corn and soybean being, you know, in rain-fed systems like we have in the state mostly, if you start getting, you know, more likely to have more drought years, that's a hard system for corn soybean production. And so if we're moving, you know, these systems that need regular rain throughout the growing season, if we're moving them west and we'll be more likely to get drought conditions, you're more likely to have, you know, failed crops.
So what are some of the things that we're seeing right now in a time when it's, you know, there's been just a ton of rain, and you know, the markets are depressed, the commodity prices are low, there's an international trade war going on. Farmers have to make decisions. So they're making decisions that they hope will sustain the next generation of farm families, that will sustain the land, but they're also making decisions about the very survival. It's no good if you go bankrupt and have to sell out to some corporation, right? So tell me a little bit about how urgent some of those decisions about making, about how we use our landscapes, can really feel on a day-to-day basis out in the field.
Well, and I think you are bringing up a really important issue between, there's the short-term, really urgent demand of, this is how a lot of South Dakotans make their income. And, you know, both directly in agriculture and then these related fields. And so there really are very short-term, you have to decide, can you get your corn in this year? You know, or were your fields flooded and you have to think about something else? And then there are these long-term implications of, do you want this to stay in your family and do something? Or, you know, are you even setting yourself up for systems that you can continue in the long term? Or do you have to look at trying something new? And so I think there really is that very strong tension between, there's the short term, and there definitely are big issues in the short term, as you mentioned too, about the, you know, not being able to sell soybeans to China being a huge challenge for farmers. You know, what do they do in the short term? And then they also have these long-term pressures. It just makes it for another really challenging time for farmers.
Tell me, as a researcher, what are some of the ways that you look at how we value our landscapes, how we use our landscapes? Where do you begin? What kind of questions do you start? Because a lot of us ask the question of what's happening right now to farmers' lives. As a researcher, what kind of questions do you ask?
So I have taken some of my research efforts at this longer-term approach of thinking about, so not necessarily trying to be prescriptive about what should we do, you know, right now in these conditions, but starting to collect data to tell the story about, might there be different ways that we could manage our landscapes in the future. And so the current systems in terms of government programs, subsidies, insurance, really gives farmers very narrow opportunities, like corn and soybean systems here in the far eastern part of the state. You know, it is a, farming is a risky business, and we have risk management factors for corn and soybean production, and it's hard for farmers to break out into a different system. And so I'm interested in starting to collect the data to tell the story that there could be other ways that we could manage our landscapes, because it isn't fair to expect that farmers could move to another system without being able to see how that system could work for them. And largely because farming is so risky, you know, and right, so we need to give examples of, here's another way you could do it, and here's a way that you could do it, you know, and not be risking your family livelihood or your the generations that you'd been hoping to pass on to your children.
Right. So what sort of, how does that branch out? Does that branch out into, you know, here are groups of people who are doing innovative things? Does it branch out into here's the technology that's going to change and provide new systems? Where do you start looking for that data?
So I think, right, a range of factors. One of the things that, so I recently joined the board of EcoSun Prairie Farms, and the focus of EcoSun Prairie Farms was this idea of doing education and demonstration about, are there ways we could put prairie back on the landscape in ways that could be used for economically viable activities? And so, you know, that focus of those efforts are in education and demonstration and showing, okay, here's what you can do. My PhD research, some of which I've continued, is looking at, you know, more collecting data on what are yields you could get, what are nutrient inputs you would need to do, you know, some of that collecting data to get the information. And then certainly others are looking at like economic and other implications of, you know, if you'd switch systems.
All right. So putting prairie back on the landscape, let's answer the big question, why? Why does it matter to have prairie on the landscape, and how much have we already lost?
So we on the eastern part of the state are in the tallgrass prairie region, and some estimates are that there is less than a tenth of 1% of the original tallgrass prairie remaining, and almost everyone would agree that there's less than 1% of the tallgrass prairie remaining. And so the tallgrass prairie is our native ecosystem here. In the central part of the state, it would have been like mixed grass, and then the western part would have been shortgrass prairie. But the tallgrass prairie is a region that has enough precipitation for agriculture. The soils from the prairie are exceptionally good, and so it's been, you know, by and large converted into agriculture. And so it's mostly gone. And so getting it back, I think getting our native ecosystem back has a tremendous amount of benefits in terms of biodiversity, you know, carbon sequestration, reducing pollution. It does a lot of services that, you know, historically would have just been provided, but now we have to think about how might we incorporate it into our current landscape, you know, which is used for the economic, you know, activities of a lot of people in the state.
When did this happen? Over decades, centuries? What's the pace of the disappearance of the tallgrass prairie?
A lot of it was homesteading. So with Euro-American settlement of this region, once that it was recognized that this land is really great for farming. And so that was really the big loss. And then South Dakota in the past decade or so, when there was the increased subsidies for corn grain ethanol, then there was another round of loss of grassland from putting more land in corn and soybean production because there was the increased, you know, market for the corn. And so historically, most of it was lost quite a while ago, but we're doing another resurgence in the loss of grassland. Mm-hmm. And even in the whole United States, eastern South Dakota is leading the country in terms of our loss of grassland right now. We're just seeing a lot of loss that isn't seen other places, and it's because of this idea that corn and soybeans, you know, for the past decade had been productive and, of course, profitable. And, of course, this year is challenging.
Right. So when that's lost, you mentioned biodiversity. Like, explain more in depth, please. Like, what is lost? Because those are big words that, you know, are not very specific. What exactly are we losing by losing tallgrass prairie, that much of it at that pace?
So some of the things, right, if we tallgrass prairies in terms of, let's say, nutrients, don't lose nutrients from the system. The plants would take it up and then they would cycle it back and use it every year. So when we think about, you know, most of the water bodies in the state, you know, having contamination of various sorts, prairies generally don't do that. They don't lose nutrients like that. And if you can incorporate them into agricultural landscapes, they can help, you know, take up some of those nutrients that you end up applying to corn systems or soybean systems but leak out. In terms of, let's say, habitat for animals, you know, that most of the native species in the region would have evolved with the prairies around here. So, for example, like grassland birds, when you look at different groups of animals that are different groups of birds that are declining, grassland birds lead the way, and they needed this habitat. And so, the extent to which, you know, we plow it up and put it in other ecosystems, some whole groups of animals, you know, are suffering tremendously because of it. Carbon sequestration, of course, with climate change, one of the things is our emissions are really high, but also as we're taking up parts of the landscape that do biological carbon sequestration, so in the terms of prairie, it holds it in the roots and puts it in the soil, you know, we're losing that and we're putting the carbon up into the air. And so, you know, those are some of the things that we lose when we lose the prairie.
So the challenges of returning, putting prairie back on the landscape, obviously the system of the economic system, the way we feed the world, all these are pretty big challenges to overcome. Where do you begin?
I think there are a lot of different ways we can begin to approach it. And so one, of course, there are government conservation programs, and we should have those. We should continue to use them. But there's only so much of the landscape those can cover. And as we've talked about, the landscape is how a lot of people make their income. And so I think we have to think about how could you make prairies profitable? And that's things where work like the EcoSun Project is trying to give the data to say, you know, here's ways that you could grow this other type of agricultural system in a way that could be profitable. And then there's also the idea of could we do targeted management of the landscape as a way of putting prairie back, but in specific places on the landscape to get disproportionate benefits. So an example of work at Iowa State, you know, they might put 10% of a watershed back into prairie, but see 90% reductions in soil loss from erosion and 90% loss of nutrients, or the nutrients that are kept in the system and not lost as pollution. And so you could, you know, another thing would be to put prairie back in strategically targeted locations and then get a bunch of benefits. And so I think all of those we have to think about as possibilities.
Is it a hard sell in general, or do you hear people really clamoring for it and just saying, yeah, this is something I want to do, but you got to make it so I can do it and survive?
I think a little of both. There's some amount of people don't see it, and an idea of doing something that's very different from what everyone around you is doing is hard, and so that's where we need demonstration areas. But then also, there need to be the support. So with this idea that farming is risky, if you can't get, you know, insurance to do a different crop than corn and soybean, it's really hard to be willing to do that. And so, but farmers are very creative, understand the landscape, understand how to manage it. And so I think the more they could be given freedom to manage in ways that I think a lot of them understand, you know, they would adopt it. It's that the systems that we have set up don't allow that kind of innovation. You know, the farmers aren't incentivized to do the innovation that I think they otherwise would do.
Let's start with some of the folks you mentioned, EcoSun Prairie Farms. Tell us a little more about some of the people who are doing work in the region to do the research, do the data collection, do the education, and find out what the future could be like.
So EcoSun Prairie Farms started, I think, in about 2011, but it was a group of researchers primarily up in Brookings at SDSU, and I think with the ARS unit up there with the USDA, but bought essentially a full section of land, so almost a square mile, up there by Brookings is kind of in the prairie pothole region where, you know, we have a lot of tile drainage, but if there wasn't the tile drainage, there'd be a lot of wetlands. And so they plugged up the tile drainage, so the wetlands came back, and then they put the landscape into prairie. And for, I think it was 7 years where there was the restoration efforts, but being able to show, you know, when you put the prairie back and you get the wetlands, and then they would sell seed, they'd sell hay, they had livestock grazing there, you'd have wetland seed. And so some amount of that you could make products off of the prairie, but then also measuring the birds came back, you know, when they had the wetlands and the frogs and the, you know, other species responding to it, the environmental benefits like reduced pollution. And so some examples of farmers could go there and see, you know, a full square mile put back on the landscape that looked so different than all the corn around it, you know, and so in that included, oh, I'm sorry, EcoSun Prairie Farm would have started in more like 2007. And I was thinking it was going during the 2012 drought, but it was one where, you know, the corn all around it was suffering from not getting enough moisture during the growing season. And sure, these prairie plants are fine. They've adapted to having, you know, a range of conditions. And so you could compare what these annual crops around it looked like to where you have these perennials on the landscape and where you've allowed the water to kind of stay on the landscape to be available throughout the growing season.
Hmm. And so what else? Who else is doing work that's innovative that you've noticed?
And so Iowa State, so again, where I got my PhD is why I'm right, so familiar with this, but they're looking at that other approach of the targeted conservation. And so where you would look at the watershed scale and you would say, okay, where are you seeing, you know, a lot of the erosion or a lot of the loss of soil, nutrient pollution and things like that, and then targeting putting prairies back on the landscape at those places where you're seeing problems. And so that started out with researchers doing it on public land, but now it's moved into a second round where they're working with farmers, doing it at the landscape scale, you know, dealing with what works with farmers. And so that's another one where it's putting prairie back on the landscape. It's a different structure in that it's targeted and it's smaller amounts of prairie, but a different model for doing that.
Is it as simple as stopping doing what you were already doing, or is it more complicated to bring prairie back to say not only do we have to not do one thing, but we have to do these other 10 things? Tell me how complicated that transition is.
And there is the range. So there could be, you know, from the EcoSun approach where they're stopping drainage tiles, putting the whole landscape back into prairie, you know, is a many-year process and involved quite a bit. Putting strips of prairie into the landscape is not that dissimilar from grassed waterways or other things that farmers are already doing. And so, you know, that one, there'd be some amount of the farmer would have to make sure they didn't spray it when they came through and managed, but not, you know, not as hard to do, whereas some of the things would be, you know, a bigger shift in how the farm was functioning.
For some of our urban listeners, explain drainage tiles.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah. So this area, there are wet spots in the landscape. So we have a lot of what are called ephemeral wetlands. And so you might call them ponded spots or low spots, but areas where it's wet. And when you have corn and soybeans, you have to get in the spring and plant the crops. And so you do not want parts on your field where the water stands. And so they put perforated pipe under the ground. And what that functionally does is it lowers the water table and it helps the water move off the landscape more quickly. And so instead of having these low pockets where water kind of sits, you can move it off and then you move the water either into a drainage ditch or into a nearby creek or something, but it's a way of moving the water more quickly off the landscape by putting pipes underground.
And how is it problematic? What kind of problems can it cause for the ecosystem?
Tile drainage. So a big one is that it's moving the water fast, but the other thing that's in the water is nutrients, and particularly nitrogen. So nitrogen is water soluble. It gets in the water, and then it moves right into your water bodies. And so drainage tile really helps exacerbate nitrogen pollution. Another thing that it does is, I mean, exactly what it's supposed to do is it moves water off the landscape, but it also means that water is not there doing other things that it could be doing. And so, you know, if you have a drought, you are trying to dry out the landscape on purpose. Another thing that it would do, if you have the tile drains in there, is naturally around here, for example, we have selenium in the soil, which some people are looking at. It would just normally have stayed in the soil, but now kind of higher levels are moving out, which can be problematic to water bodies. So there's some amount of, it just changes systems in different ways. And so it helps farming in some ways, and then some it causes some challenges.
Talk a little bit about when we talk in this region about solar energy and wind energy and just other ways of generating power, how does that sort of intersect with the work that you do?
So I don't specifically look at, let's say, wind energy or solar energy in terms of specifics of it. But, for example, wind energy is one that is really aligns well with our types of agricultural systems. And so, you know, in states where there's policies to really support it, you see broad adoption. So let's say even Texas, which really leads in a lot of wind power, whereas you can put it on agricultural land. And so you can still farm the land below it, but then, you know, you're getting the wind above it to get renewable energy. And so in South Dakota, we haven't had strong policy to encourage wind energy development, but we certainly could, and we're a windy state and have, it could align with agriculture extremely well. We would need investments in infrastructure to move the energy, you know, to places that are more populated, but definitely solar or wind energy would fit well in South Dakota. And solar energy, again, that we would have a lot of opportunities. People think about cold states maybe not doing as well. We have very sunny, you know, winters and summers on average. And so we could also add solar energy. And that's another one that isn't incompatible with agriculture. You can make it fit in spaces that wouldn't compete with agriculture.
When we talk about incentives and, we're going to talk later in this program about subsidies for the, you know, during the international trade war and sort of keeping farmers going. And a few of the things we've talked about, you've said, you know, this is something that has to be promoted or sent, you know, there has to be an incentive for it. then are we in the, what realm are we in there? Is that the realm of politics and sort of people just getting on board with the data science or the data or the research? Tell me how some of the challenges that need to be overcome just to get to the point of opening the door toward different policies.
Yes, I mean, the policy. So a lot of these changes, policy is what holds them in place. And it certainly is often the case. So agriculture, and particularly agribusiness, has very strong lobbying power. And so it is a challenging area to make change. But it is, for example, if you can get crop insurance for corn and soybeans, but you couldn't get crop insurance if you grew prairie to sell for seed, that is a hard thing for someone to say they're going to, you know, plant something that they can't get insurance for if it was a bad year. And so it is hard to get these policy changes because it's a very well-funded, well-organized, you know, agricultural lobby that it would be up against. But policy could make a huge difference. And so I think everyone, sometimes there's the idea that people are thinking that farmers are choosing to not do things that would be in the best interest of the environment. And I think, you know, people who work in the space would recognize that there are pretty strong limitations put on, you know, what is allowable if people want to make farming work for them. And it's not at the level of the individual farmer. It's at the level of these kind of larger policy type or institutional type systems in terms of what they can do, you know, to mitigate risk and expect to make profit.
Hmm. So do the solutions already exist? And it's just a matter of working with policy and convincing people to sort of see things in a different way. There's a sort of a paradigm shift that needs to happen. Or are we still really in the process of learning what works, what doesn't? How do you make prairie profitable? What happens when you bring prairie back? What happens when you don't? I mean, do we have the knowledge that we need and just not the will?
Both. So we certainly know an awful lot. And policy changes, even the idea of targeted conservation, that wouldn't be that hard. It would change small amounts of the landscape. And so there is a ton that we could do now with policy shifts. Could we know more? Absolutely, especially with climate change. So we know that we're going to have more extreme weather events. So I had been talking about drought, you know, in the 2012 drought. And then, of course, this year it was the exact opposite. So we have had, you know, record precipitation, and that is exactly what's expected with policy or with climate change, that we're going to have more extreme weather events, and so we'll have more drought years, and then these more extreme wet years, and the timing of the precipitation will change. And so we absolutely need to understand that better, and we need to understand how, you know, in these new systems, how we can make that work, but we know a ton already.
Yeah, how in the world can you plan for extreme weather events?
Well, you can. I mean, so one of the things, I'd like to sell prairie again, but the idea of if you have an annual crop and there's flooding in the spring, you can't get in the fields to plant it. If you have a perennial crop, for example, prairie, it doesn't matter if you can get in your fields in the spring, the prairie will happily start growing, you know? And so some of that, we know that there are different types of systems that are more and less resilient to extreme weather events. Corn and soybean, corn especially, is extremely productive. You get a lot of saleable product. But it requires very specific conditions. And so if we're moving into a situation where we're more likely to have these extremes, extreme drought, extreme wetness, then we need to think about other systems that are more resilient to that. And we know that there are a range of those. And so it's a matter of, you know, recognizing that this is going to be the new normal, you know, that we don't get shocked every year that it's the wettest year, or the hottest year, or the driest year. That's just going to increasingly happen, and we need to, again, change our agricultural systems to be able to tolerate that. But we know a bunch about how to do that.
What is a saleable product from prairie?
So it could be the seed. It could be the hay for animals to eat. It could be if we went to biofuel, you know, you'd sell it to either burn it or to make into a liquid fuel. It could be carbon sequestration if we put a market on that. It could be reduced nutrient pollution if we put a market on.
What do you mean if you put a market on carbon sequestration? What does that
mean? So like when there was cap and trade discussions or a carbon tax, so if there was a market to, you either had a limit on the amount of carbon emissions you could make if you were an industry, or there was a tax just for the amount of carbon you emitted, it would allow people to sell things where they were pulling carbon out of the air. And prairie is one of the things, and wetlands are one of the things that can sequester carbon or pull it out of the air.
That sounds like money for nothing. Literally, do nothing.
And oh, yes, if you put it back on.
There's a system in place that pays you for doing nothing because it values the fact that you're doing nothing because it's not really nothing, then the system changes. Am I catching on?
Yes. Okay. I mean, if we valued carbon, it would really change what people could do because you could, if you were doing, let's say, a farming system that was tilling up your soil a lot or allowing a lot of decomposition, which lost soil and lost carbon into the air, that wouldn't make as much sense as something where it was pulling carbon out of the air and storing it for long amounts of time. And so, yeah, having a price on carbon changes the equation on a range of things.
Whose responsibility is it? Is it the government's responsibility to subsidize and change those systems? Is it farmers working who live in, stewards of the land? Whose responsibility do you see pushing this conversation forward?
I think we all need to have the conversation. I think one thing we don't want to do is say it is the farmer's responsibility, because I think that puts them in an unfair position. I think a lot of it is broader than what the farmers can do. We need policy changes. We need other ways of incentivizing things. We need to get them different messages. And so farmers absolutely should be good stewards, and I think by and large they are. And so continue to do that. Continue to tell the story, have farmers continue to say where there are challenges that they need other people to speak for them. But it is one that, even though agriculture is, the dominant economic activity in the state of South Dakota, most people in the state are not farmers working the land. And so there need to be advocates far beyond the farmers, and the farmers can be part of that solution.
What's the promise of precision ag? As we move forward and look at, artificial intelligence and machine learning, are you optimistic about the potential there? Or
absolutely, yes. I think that can do a ton of good. And so we know, as I mentioned, the Prairie Pothole region, there are these low spots in fields. And farmers know this too, that on average they don't, the crops might die every year and they just get the insurance payments. People know that if you just even didn't plant that you would make more money than having to spend seed and pay for the fertilizer for those parts of the landscape. And so precision agriculture would allow farmers to not be putting fertilizer where they don't need it, not be planting crops where it's unlikely to be able to grow anyway. And so it certainly economically has a lot of advantages for farmers, but then environmentally, those places that are losing money are also probably places where you could get these disproportionate benefits. If you put that low spot into prairie, instead of draining that water off the landscape, you could keep it there and it could help, reduce the nutrient pollution. And so, yeah, I think there's a ton of opportunity with precision agriculture that we can try and manage the landscape in more of an optimized way rather than, doing the same thing everywhere.
What are you most optimistic about in your realm of research and even in teaching? What gives you a lot of hope for the future? Because a lot of the stories we hear about, ag and agribusiness and climate change are pretty doom and gloom.
Well, I think that there's a lot of different options that we could do, and I think there is one that farmers are not people that are fighting this. They're people that want the best for the landscape. And so I'm optimistic about the more we increasingly recognize that the current systems are likely to have problems going forward. So an idea that, let's say, in eastern South Dakota, most of the landscape would be in either corn or soybean most of the time. I think we're going to recognize that that's problematic, and then we'll be open to looking for other opportunities. And we'll have the research and demonstration to kind of show people, here's options that you could consider.
Yeah. Dr. Megan Darko, thank you so much for being here with us today. Appreciate your time. You're welcome back anytime.
Thank you.